The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to seven continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to our Tuesday evening Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you for tuning in. It's a gorgeous night in the San Francisco Bay Area. A little warm, but really nice. I wish I could do this show outside next to the bay because the bay is right across the street from me with the walking pass, but sorry, I don't have that technology, but it would be fun. But we have a great show planned for you, and I'm excited about being here, and thank you for tuning in. Toll-free number for those of you who would like to give us a call and talk to our guest tonight, who I will introduce in just a minute, 1-866-687-7223. Remember, no call screeners. Be patient and let the phone ring. We'll answer it, get you up on air as quickly as possible. Also, do remember that we will hold you over breaks. We will answer the phone during the break. So when we have a break coming up, don't let that stop you from using the toll-free number. However, for tonight, there will be no break because we are doing the 60-minute format show. So if you have a question or a comment for our guest, pay attention to the clock. And make sure you get it in before we run out on the 60-minute format. So our guest is with us from the East Coast, much, much later there than here in still daylight California. So we're glad to make the shows more convenient for people in different time zones. You can also reach us through email, drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com, and our blog, which is thespaceshow.com. All the way over to the far right side is a menu called Upcoming Shows. This is the first show listed in that category. That is also the page for the blog archive of our show. So open it up, and comments and questions are down at the bottom. And as soon as you post your comment or question, I will get it. By the way, the guest will get a copy of it as well if he's on the website. And we'll bring it up on air, and let's see what our guest has to say in response to what it is that you're inquiring about. But the telephone is the preferred way. We much prefer your speaking with us. 1-866-687-7223. Just a couple of other real quick announcements. Make sure you check the Listen Live menu on the upper left. So we've clarified that for how to listen to live programs, archive programs, normal podcast. And then for those of you doing Alexa, we have the embedded TuneIn player on the website now, and you'll see it there. And for Alexa-compatible podcast, you've got it right there under Listen Live as well. We know we have some ratio issues with our logo, and we're working with TuneIn to correct that. But the player works fine. And again, I'm going to make an appeal out there for any of you using Alexa. On an open line show sometime, call in and tell me why you're using it. What's the benefit of it? I don't understand much about it, and I am happy to accommodate those that are using it. But I'd like to know more about it, and I would appreciate your helping me out with that. Or just send me a private email. That would work as well. So also on our website, don't forget we do have a detailed website newsletter. And if you scroll down, it shows all of the upcoming shows we have scheduled. And we are booking toward the end of the year already. Remember, everything we do is archived, so you can listen right off of our website or easily download the show. To me, the most important button there is support the Space Show. So we are a 501c3 nonprofit with one O-N-E, GiantLeapFoundation.org. And many of you do financially support the Space Show, and that does keep us on the air, and we're really appreciative of your support. Remember, if you're a U.S. federal taxpayer, you do get a tax deduction for your gift. If you're a California taxpayer, you also get a tax deduction. In California, our status is that of a public benefit corporation. So we certainly do appreciate your support. We have corporate sponsors as well. You will see their banner ads going across the homepage. We still have some remaining corporate sponsor positions available. If you're interested, inquire at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Normally, I would read a short one-minute message from each of our corporate sponsors, but because we're on the 60-minute format tonight, I'm just going to thank our sponsors, and I really do thank them. We wouldn't be doing the show without their wonderful help and support. So let me remind you that the New Worlds Conference is just around the corner, November 10th through the 11th in Austin, Texas, and you can check that one out at newworlds2017.space. And the Space Plan is a sponsor for us as well. Remember, they have their new one out since ISDC. It is at www.thespaceplan.com. This is the integrated space plan that details a 100-year forecast for our future in space. Remember also, they have a new kids space plan. Great sponsor, and we thank you very much for being a sponsor. The Space Foundation is our sponsor, and their 34th symposium is just around the corner, April 16th through the 19th of next year. Again, Colorado Springs, Colorado at the Broadmoor Hotel, spacesymposium.org. And then again, tomorrow, their investment and technology two-day program is at the JW Marriott Hotel on Mason Street in San Francisco. If those of you listening are attending, please look for me. I look just like my website picture, except I have white hair. And or email me and I'll give you my cell phone so we can hook up. I'm going to be there, and I would love to meet Space Show listeners in person. That's a big, important deal for me. So if you're coming to San Francisco for this Space Foundation meeting tomorrow and Thursday, do let me hear from you. Orbital ATK is a great sponsor. We appreciate them as well. AIAA, the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, is our sponsor. And then Celestis, which is the only proven and premier memorial spaceflight organization on the planet. And in full disclosure, I am their customer. They have sent my mom and my dog's ashes and DNA to space, suborbital as well as orbital multiple times. And I love these people. I tell you that all the time. They're a great sponsor, probably one of the best businesses I've ever dealt with in my life. And the service and the whole program is exceptional. So with that, I want to introduce our guest, but I want to make something clear up front, because our guest came to us as a guest because he called a Space Show program as a listener when another guest was talking about something that interested him. And obviously, as you will hear, the guy is intelligent, articulate, had a lot to say, and he got invited to be a full-time Space Show guest. So that is a way for you to become a Space Show guest. He didn't self-invite himself, but talking to him for 30 seconds, I realized that this is someone we needed to have on the Space Show. So I just want to let you know that that is a path to being on the Space Show, especially if you're articulate and you have something to say. So I do want to welcome Dan, and I hope I get your name right, Mosqueda.
That's right.
Thank God for that, with my Oklahoma twang. He's the manager of National Security Program Development for the University's Space Research Association, USRA. This is a scientific research and advanced technology company at the forefront of space-related testing and assessments. He works out of their headquarters in Columbia, Maryland. He's a retired lieutenant colonel in the Air Force, and he joined USRA from headquarters at Air Force Space Command, Directorate of Requirements Policy and Integration Division. I could read his impressive bio, and trust me, it is very, very impressive with the Air Force and what he has done. But because we're on the 60-minute format, I'm not going to do that. But I always tell you to read their bios because they're really interesting. Dan's is really interesting. Very, very cool. And as I said, retired colonel in the Air Force, lots of great accomplishments and activities with the Air Force and now with USRA. Dan, welcome to the Space Show. How are you?
I'm doing great, David. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate this opportunity to tell your listeners a little bit about USRA and then about the idea of using OTAs to advance space technology.
Well, let's start out, and maybe a lot of listeners are not familiar with USRA, so give us the 101 introduction to what we're talking about.
Okay. So USRA is a 501c3 nonprofit corporation. We're headquartered in Columbia, Maryland, where I am right now. We were founded in 1969 by James Webb, the NASA administrator during the Apollo era, and Frederick Seitz, the president of the National Academy of Sciences. And essentially what they wanted to do was constitute an entity which could bring universities, other research organizations, and the governments, and even other nations together toward the development, application of space-related science, technology, and engineering. So what's really interesting in our history is our first big mission was to be responsible for taking care of the samples that returned from the Apollo mission. So we actually, you know, were taking care of and doing research along with member universities on the moon rocks that came back. And we still do that. In fact, as recently as I think about a year and a half ago, we put out, some research literature on some different aspects of those that we found. USRA is comprised of 106 PhD granting universities. 96 of them are in the U.S. and then 10 are international. They pretty much are a who's who of the nation's large schools or very high-end research universities like the University of Chicago, University of Michigan, Harvard, Cornell, George Washington University, Howard University, University of Kansas, University of New Mexico, and the list goes on. And then we're governed by them. They select our actual board of trustees, who then provide guidance and governance to our CEO, who is Dr. Jeff Isaacson, who then leads the organization to, do our day-to-day business, which these days is serving the government in numerous capacities at several of the NASA centers, Air Force Research Labs, and the Air Force Academy, as well as some work for the Department of Energy and the National Science Foundation. So some of our big projects that your listeners may have heard of would include SOFIA, which is the Stratospheric Observatory for Radio Infrared Astronomy.
Yeah, we've done a lot of programming on SOFIA over the years. Great program.
Great program. And then, of course, the Arecibo Observatory in Puerto Rico. We are partners with SRI on that particular site, and we're very proud of that. And then, of course, our list of scientific and engineering areas we work on is pretty extensive. So we've got about 10 big programs right now, and they're actually from coast to coast. I think one of the ones that I'm most proud of is our AFRL Scholars Program, which allows juniors and seniors in high school through PhD candidates to do real science, real engineering, and real R&D at the Air Force Research Labs sites in Albuquerque, Maui, Eglin Air Force Base in Florida, and Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio. And they do great work there. They learn a lot about what it's like to be a government scientist and engineer, and then hopefully they go on either to work for the labs or to work for industry, say whether it would be Boeing or Lockheed Martin or a smaller company, or even Sandia National Labs. So that's a pretty quick snapshot of USRA and what we're all about. And I would also like to point out that our primary facility where we really started is in Clear Lake, Texas, in Houston near the Johnson Space Center. And, of course, you know, our thoughts and prayers go out to the people in Houston and some of our employees who everyone is safe but certainly suffered some damage. The Lunar Planetary Institute that we operate down there will be opening, I believe, tomorrow, depending on the weather. And I'm proud to say that USRA, you know, put its best foot forward and donated a significant sum to the Red Cross to help victims of Harvey, and I would encourage all of your listeners to do the same thing.
LPI is part of USRA?
LPI is actually the founding institute of USRA. It started out, it was called the Lunar Science Institute, and then later became LPI. And the Lunar Planetary Institute is something that we still operate to this day.
So you're strictly Air Force and Air Force related. You don't do anything with, say, the Naval Research Labs or any of the other military schools or anything like that. Is that correct?
Actually, we do. I did neglect to say we actually do some work for the Naval Observatory, and we're on a contract for the Army Research Labs. We just don't have any active work going on at this very moment. But, yeah, we will work with anybody in the government, and we even have some commercial partners, including Google and Nissan. So it's a pretty interesting mix of science, technology, and engineering that we do.
And so it's a 501c3, so how is it basically funded? Who donates to it? Where did you get the funding for it?
So most of the funding comes as a result of the contracts that we compete for and then operate for the government. In some cases, they're cooperative agreements where there are no fees, but we get you know, payment for all the employees and some of the overhead. And then in other cases, there are actual contracts where there's a little bit of fee, and that kind of is what we use to be able to do what it takes in order to keep, you know, our employees well paid and good insurance and all that. And additionally, we have a pretty significant STEM activity center at our headquarters and sponsor STEM activity around the nation. So that's where we do most of it. We do have some money that comes in via grants from other companies and other foundations, but that's mostly for our STEM programs.
So you sent me a lot of different backup materials for the program tonight and to help me know more about USRA. So there's a couple of things under this PowerPoint slide, but I don't see the number on the slide, but number 8. That caught my attention. So one was under what we do, space life sciences. So I wanted you to be a little more detailed about this. But this one is and that's a big topic on the space show. But this next one is really a big topic on the space show, and we're all interested in this, and that's space nuclear power and propulsion. So what are you actually doing with space nuclear power and propulsion?
So we have an office out at Idaho National Labs,
okay.
And we are working on a couple different programs that are intended to do research on how we could, you know, further our use of different types of nuclear power for both propulsion and for energy on board a spacecraft. And we have developed some different concepts, which I can't go into a lot of detail on, but the idea is, you know, how do you use these sources of power because you need them for long-range missions, and how do you do it safely? Of course, the most difficult use case for them would be, say, anything in low Earth orbit, but our scientists and engineers out there are looking at some of these really tough use cases and trying to figure out, you know, what's the best way to do it. How do you encapsulate the material? How do you generate, you know, safely generate power? And I know that we've worked on some things where we had the power cells down to the size of a D cell battery, actually, in order to do that.
Do you believe that space nuclear power is going to be something that is plausible and actually happens? I mean, everybody on the space show for the 17 years I've been doing the show has wanted to see nuclear propulsion come about, but obviously it's not there. Are you optimistic, or is this just research for the sake of research?
I wouldn't say that it's research for the sake of research, but I would say that it is a very challenging topic. It's a difficult science, and I think the key to it all is safety, because after all, you know, we want to help the government make the best decisions and give them the best technological solutions possible if they choose to go in this direction. So I don't really have an opinion on, you know, what's going to actually happen with it in the future. I just know that it is something that they're always looking at, because when you start to think about really long-range missions or a mission where you're going to rely on, say, something that requires a lot of energy for short periods of time, let's say it's, you know, some sort of a, maybe it's a radar in space or whatever, chances are it's going to be a lot more difficult to do with solar power that you would generate on orbit or in spaceflight.
Does USRA do any funding or technological support with commercial efforts? So I'm thinking of Vasimir, for example, that does do some things with NASA, but what about with USRA?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay, you have a caller already online. Hi, caller. Welcome to our show. Who are you? Where are you, please?
David, I'm going to shock you. This is Michael Listener calling in at 10 o'clock my time.
Well, you don't vaporize, so I'm not that shocked. You're not going to lose your slippers and turn into a pumpkin. I keep telling you that.
The sarcasm is thick tonight, isn't it?
That's right. Are you going to be a Debbie Downer here, or you got something really great to tell us?
No, I'm going to try not to be a Debbie Downer. Hi, Dan. I like the nuclear power discussion and such. The question is, are you, I understand from what you've been talking about, USRA is really focusing heavy on technical in regards to nuclear power. I can understand that, but are you also looking at policy angles as well? Because, I mean, it's the big stickler that's killed nuclear power is terms of propulsion and really wide range uses beyond actually powering space probes has been politics. And I know there's a lot of, because when you talk nuclear, everybody's like, oh my God, you know, it's this horrible thing that's going to wipe out all life on Earth. And I think that's a big consideration that, you know, in one vein, you've got to take a look at the how can you develop a safe system, but at the same time, you've got to, you know, look at how you can convince that people that it isn't going to wipe out or cause a mass extinction on the planet Earth.
Right. So to be honest, we don't get terribly involved in policy. Certainly, you know, our scientists and engineers, you know, called upon would provide input into, you know, best case and worst case scenarios of safety and that type of propulsion and anything else that we're working on. Where we get involved in policy generally involves advocating for our university members in terms of things like ICAR restrictions and other areas, but we don't currently have any work that is directly related to providing policy advice or recommendations.
Well, and I kind of raise the issue a little bit more because I know the UN has been looking at its nuclear safety protocols that it has in place. I understand these are non-binding, but they're looking at modifying them, and this is something they've been working on for a couple, pretty actively this year. So, it's something that it's not only a national thing, but it has international implications as well.
Yeah. So, again, at this point, we're just working on the science and technical side of it, and whether or not any of this gets used is probably a question for somebody else.
Right.
But
okay, that's fair.
Sorry, Michael. I wish I could give you a better answer.
No, it's an answer, and that's good enough for me.
Yeah.
Anything else, Michael?
No, that's it for tonight, David.
Thank you very much for your call. Good hearing from you again.
Yeah, bye.
So, listeners, Michael opens up our toll-free line, and that number is 1-866-687-7223. The other thing on this list of what we do from your PowerPoint that caught my attention was space life sciences. So is this like human factors, aerospace medicine issues, microgravity, radiation, vision problems, things of that nature? Is that what you're talking about?
Yes. So USRA at one time, in the very recent past, had a division of life sciences down at our Lunar Planetary Institute facility. And right now we are not doing that work specifically, though we certainly maintain a lot of the research. And I know that in the past, they were looking at a lot of things you just brought up, including things like bone density, the impact on, the ocular impact, in terms of pressure from space flight and stuff like that. But
right.
We're not actively working in that area right now.
Too bad. that area needs some work. And any plans to go back into that work?
I'm not sure. I can't really say.
Our friend Jody sent you an email, and I know you were copied on it, but let me read it for the listeners who have not seen it. And Jody, if you're listening live or on archives, I would still love to have you back, have you on the space show per our discussion at the New Space Conference about your program. If you can get permission to do it, let me know. But Jody has three questions. She's down in Silicon Valley for you. One, how do you see other transaction authorities enabling speed of capability for DOD? Number two, can you comment on how requirements are generated and how they might drive a prototype acquisition strategy? And number three, how do corporate business models impact speed and agility of acquisitions, I guess is translated in how do people and corporations or government respond quicker to issues that come up, right?
Right. So let's actually tackle number two, because in the order of things, developing, generating requirements, is going to be the first thing that happens before any of these other items are able to happen. And essentially, where all of this begins is there's some sort of a national need, and typically in the Department of Defense, that is going to be determined by what we call a combatant commander's integrated priority list. So they'll generate what we call a bona fide requirement, and they'll say, look, we need to, be able to fly an airplane from point A to point B in this amount of time. I shouldn't even say fly an airplane. We need to be able to move from point A to point B in this amount of time, with maybe some circumstances and things thrown in that are wrinkles. And then from there, we start generating requirements. We might do an analysis of alternatives. And well, what could we do? Well, we could, you know, we could put them in a rocket, or we could put them in an airplane, or we could do this or that, the other thing. And you start to work through these potential solutions until you come up with what seems like the best answer to that given problem. And then those requirements are generated at a high level. And then when it comes time to, once everything's been approved and gone through all the machinations, then it will get put into some sort of a request for information, out to industry, and then eventually into a request for proposal, and at the same time, a product center for the military is going to work on the actual detailed technical requirements. You know, it's got to be, you know, this size, this speed. It's got to meet these standards, and a lot of the really in the weeds details. So once those requirements are generated, where I see this prototype acquisition strategy, which is what Jody's talking about in the other transaction authorities, and I'll get into detail on that in a minute, is that instead of saying, I need this entire satellite, we might look at, you know, certain areas where we know we can build something and certain areas where we're not quite sure. So we might choose to reduce risk by generating a couple different prototypes and seeing which one works the best. And this might be a sensor, this might be propulsion, this might be a computer, this might be software, it could be algorithms, any number of different types of things that you would want to know before you went ahead with your full acquisition strategy. So that's kind of how, you know, in a really short, elementary way, the requirements are generated, and that's what drives the military to buy equipment and, you know, airplanes and tanks and everything else. It's not just because, gee, that looks really shiny, let's go out and buy that. So it's all based on what we call a bona fide requirement. If it doesn't, if it's not a bona fide requirement, you're not going to get approval to fund it. Okay, so let's talk then next. Jody asks about other transaction authorities. And an OTA, another transaction authority, is not a new type of contracting instrument. It's actually been around since the late 50s, going back to the Apollo era. And today you would call those Space Act agreements. And the idea was back in the day they wanted to make it possible for us to go from nothing to the moon right away, so they had to remove some of the more onerous contracting methods and just make it possible to get things done. So as the years have gone by, we are now kind of swinging full circle back around to that. And back in 2000, well, would have probably been 14 and 15, but in 2016, the government, the Congress changed the law in the National Defense Authorization Act of 2016 to allow for DOD to not only do these prototype projects, but actually then be able to take that prototype and immediately put it into some sort of production for use without any further competition. And the reason this is important is if you're trying to stay ahead technologically, you don't want to then develop a prototype and then figure out how you're going to buy it later. You want to have it all wrapped into a neat package and be able to go through the process, and at the end, the other end, come out with whether it's a small satellite or it's a sensor or, like I said, maybe, you know, it's some sort of software or even business processes. You want to be able to do it quickly, much more quickly now. The other significant thing about OTAs is that they really are different than typical contracts. They are not governed by the federal acquisition regulations of the FAR. They're not grants and they're not cooperative agreements. They are a legally binding instrument, but they're much, much quicker to put out the requirement, to get ideas back from industry, and then to pick one and make it go through the process as I described just a few minutes ago. It's exempt from a lot of laws, including the Competition and Contracting Act, the Bayh-Dole in Rights and Technical Data, the Truth in Negotiations Act, and several others. And this is really important because all of those add complexity and lengthen to the time it takes in order to, you know, go out and execute via some sort of an instrument like this.
So are OTAs the preferred way of doing things now?
Well, I would not say that. I think OTAs are a way that the government can advance projects further ahead. Because if you're going to build something like, let's say, GPS, you know, a new GPS satellite or system, you're not going to be able to do the whole thing on an OTA. It's just not going to work. But there could be aspects to it that you could do through an OTA that might accelerate that larger program much faster, or it might allow you for an on-ramp for new technology. You might know that, look, it's going to take us 5 years to do this new satellite, but we know that this and this and this and this area of the satellite could be impacted by technological advancements. So we're going to, you know, intentionally build in a way that we can make these changes. And as you go down the road, you could use an OTA to go ahead and build prototypes for, you know, whatever it happens to be, whether, again, it's a sensor or an instrument, and then take that injection of new technology and make it into that existing program. Or the other thing it could do is it could be something like, let's say, a small satellite, where you're going to say, look, I need this ability, this capability on orbit for Special Operations Command, and it's a, you know, communications, or it's weather, you know, small weather satellite, or a small imaging satellite, and, you know, we're going to crank this thing out in a year. And we buy them, and we go, yep, that's what we want, and, you know, choose to go ahead and purchase 150 of them, and then start launching them and start using them. And then the idea is that by the time you're ready to replace those, technology has moved forward. So you're not stuck with 5 years ago design. You're on to, you know, whatever the latest and greatest technology is to bring to your warfighter. Does that make sense?
Yeah, perfect. So I would assume this is a pretty good system and not too many glitches in it by now, right?
Yeah, it's working well. The Army has been particularly successful at using OTAs, and so is the Navy for that matter. They use them in areas that maybe aren't even so high tech, like shipbuilding and stuff like that. But it allows them to do, you know, what I was saying, which is work on certain areas very quickly so that these larger programs are not slowed down and, in fact, can be sped up. And they've been very successful. And I think, you know, the Air Force has really started to move in this direction to say, yeah, this is where we need to go. In fact, at the PACA briefing for industry in Albuquerque, which is a fantastic event where the Air Force Research Labs and the Space and Missile Systems Center and Sandia National Labs and several other government agencies come and they brief industry on what they're trying to do. You know, the three letters OTA were brought up dozens of times by a four-star general, you know, a three-star general, a couple two-star generals, and, you know, several colonels. And, in fact, the commander of Air Force Research Labs, in his briefing had, you know, some key takeaways. And he said that under experimentation, you know, we have to have new ways of doing business. And then for speed, we need to innovate much faster. And also, the failure, you know, one key thing he said that I really liked was the failure to take risk stagnates progress. So what these generals were saying was, we cannot be afraid to fail and to take a risk, because at least we're moving forward. And hopefully, you know, if you've done your systems engineering correctly and you've thought about this, a failure is not really a failure. You've learned something and you can still move forward.
What about the third question that Jody asked in the business models, the corporate business model?
Yeah, so this is a really great question. And when you consider corporate business models and how they impact the speed and agility of acquisitions, it's really something to think about, because every company, including USRA, has processes in place. We don't just, you know, read about something and say, oh, hey, that'd be great, let's go ahead and do that. You know, we sit around and we think about, not, I don't know, I hate to use the word sit around, that sounds terrible, but we, you know, we take into consideration many factors. Is it the right thing for our company right now? Can we do the best job possible for the government? And then what a lot of companies do is they move through gate reviews. And so it's going to work its way up the chain of command at, you know, companies at different speeds and varying complexities. And it's just being good business people. The drawback to that is that it means that there are going to be companies that aren't going to do a great job at moving moving quickly. However, and I think the reason Jody probably asks this is, up in Silicon Valley, they're really, really good at being smart and doing things right and doing things quickly and being satisfied with, let's say, the 80% solution. And the government was certainly indicating at the PACA BFI for our Briefing for Industry conference that they are inclined to work in that direction as well in some areas. So what I think you're going to see at some of the larger companies as we move faster towards fielding systems is they're going to have their standard method of operating, which is appropriate for what they do, but then they're going to have innovation hubs within their companies, which will allow them to move much more quickly.
It's a changing world.
It is.
You sent me also something about Space Enterprise Consortium. So I understand this is not approved or implemented yet, but this is an OTA type of model, correct?
It is. So the Space and Missile Systems Center, about a year ago, started planning on how they might implement an OTA consortium to support the National Security Space Enterprise. And they started out by, you know, releasing a request for information, and several companies, both as potential consortium managers and as consortium members, responded and then started talking back and forth with the government until finally a request for a proposal came out. And what SMC decided to do was look for a consortium manager who could come in and run this Space Enterprise Consortium, whose goal would be to help the government go out and find these fast-acting, innovative, cutting-edge companies to develop these prototypes so that we could stay, we meaning the American people, could stay ahead of our adversaries in space, to be honest. And so they have since accepted proposals from several organizations, and General Thompson, who is the commander of SMC, told me a couple weeks ago that they're right now in the middle of source selection. And we should know probably by the end of September who the consortium manager is. And then by November, we're going to see the first couple project proposals come out of SMC to industry. And then industry will then have an opportunity to respond in a very short timeline with a white paper with answers on how they think they would do it. And then the government will look at that. And let's just say, you know, for easy math, that there's 10 white papers. Then SMC might say, I like these three ideas. They then go to those three companies or groups of companies and say, okay, tell me how you're going to do this. So then you get a little more detailed. The government says, I like that. In fact, I like all three of them. So we're going to build all three prototypes, and they're going to essentially do a fly-off. Now, they may or may not actually fly, but I'm just using that to generate the word picture of, you know, what will happen. They're going to build the prototypes, test them, and see which one will work best. And then they're going to choose, you know, probably just one of them, but who knows, it could be more, for a production agreement. And then that will go into production and become a small program of record. Then what will happen is, you know, through the years, this will continue. Because you asked about Army and Navy as far as USRA was concerned. Well, anybody in the National Security Space Enterprise will be eligible to use this OTA. They don't have to be Air Force. So it could be Army, it could be the Marine Corps, it could be Special Operations Command, and it could be even some of the different agencies like DITRA or even CIA or NRO or NSA. And they would then go to SMC and say, hey, we have this need. And SMC would then go to the consortium manager and say, okay, we have this need. And the consortium manager will reach out to the consortium members, and if they get answers, they'll go back. If a good consortium manager will continually recruit new companies as well, and if they don't think they have anybody who can answer that, they're going to go out and find other companies who can do it for them and continue to grow this consortium. Additionally, the consortium members, what we found in other OTAs is that they tend to organically grow together. They might have 30% of the solution, and they might find a company that has 40%, and, you know, and then somebody else who has the other 30%, and they come together and work together and collaborate from start to finish.
And USRA is wanting to be the consortium manager?
Yes, we did propose to be the consortium manager, and of course we hope we win that. We think we do a great job, but we think that many of the organizations who did the same will hopefully do a great job as well. And then, and the bottom line is, I think all of us want to see our nation safe and secure, and we think that these OTAs are a solid way to really stay ahead of our adversaries technologically.
You have an email from Beth in Oklahoma City.
Okay.
And she says, Dan, I have a two-part question for you, and I don't think my questions are related, but number one, does USRA have any role whatsoever in the possibility of a new Space Guard that has been talked about in Congress as well as in the news? And the second part of my question is, does the consortium management program that you're talking about for the space and missile system, does it work with our allies, or is it strictly U.S. military and national security?
Okay, so on the proposed U.S. Space Corps, which was approved by the House of Representatives for the NDAA 2018, but has not yet, the Senate's version has not been approved yet. They haven't even voted on theirs yet. So her question was, would USRA have a role?
Right. I think that's what she's asking.
Okay. So I would say that if the government, the Congress decides, to pass a law that sets up the United States Space Corps, which the timelines that they're talking about, at least on the House side, would be by 2019, we certainly would offer to help them in any way we could, just like we would any other government agency, as our mission and charter has us do. We don't know what that means. If it follows the model of the United States Marine Corps, then it seems like the Air Force Research Labs, like the Navy Research Labs, will support the United States Space Corps. So I don't think that there's going to be a space research lab separate and apart from the larger AFRL institution that exists now. And we generally work more directly with AFRL, although we do work with Air Force Space Command, so and the Air Force Academy as well. And by the way, I think that officers for a future U.S. Space Corps would go through the Air Force Academy. They're not going to set up a separate academy, at least I wouldn't imagine at this point. And that's how, like my nephew is a Marine Corps officer who went through Annapolis. So I suspect it would be very similar. So I think that answers her question. So USRA really won't have anything to do with making anything happen, but we're going to be there to support their requirements as we're able to do.
And the second part was, do you do anything with U.S. allies, or is it strictly national security for U.S. only?
So that's a really great question. The Space Enterprise Consortium right now, as it stands, is U.S. only. However, I have heard the questions asked of folks at SMC, and they kind of look quizzically and go, it should be pointed out that we do work with our allies. The advanced EHF communication satellite is a good example. We have worked with allies on that, and there are numerous other large space systems. So I suspect in the future that you would see both allies and possibly even corporations from allied nations working on some of these programs when it's possible.
Robert is in Albuquerque, New Mexico, with an email and says, I haven't heard commercial space specifically mentioned, but I'm wondering if you get involved in any dual-use commercial and DOD types of projects, especially dual use with, say, the entrepreneurial side of the commercial space industry?
So USRA does. We haven't done as much with commercial space, I don't think, as we would like to do. Of course, where we have worked, with commercial technology is on our quantum artificial intelligence lab that we operate for NASA Ames out in Mountain View. We are in a Space Act agreement with Google, USRA, of course, and NASA Ames. And Google funded the purchase of a quantum computer, and NASA Ames hosts it, and then USRA operates it and goes through all of the proposals by other companies and institutions, research institutions and universities to use it. And some of those are space-related uses of, how can we use quantum computing, in different ways, whether it's mostly optimization and scheduling, machine learning, and artificial intelligence, as the moniker of the lab would indicate.
Broadly speaking, does that also include artificial intelligence and robotics and things of that nature that are sometimes related?
Yes, it does, because, in fact, USRA wrote the software for a couple significant space programs, including the original Mars lander and rover, and then we have also worked on, over the years, some different ways of automating how some of the work is done on the International Space Station. But as far as with, I can tell you from the OTA, the spec OTA, we will be really working with a lot of commercial space companies who maybe wouldn't. That's part of the idea. I kind of left that out on the OTA. In order to work with an OTA, typically what the government is actually looking for are what they call non-traditional defense contractors. And so that's why, you know, places like Silicon Valley and Albuquerque and Austin and Boston and even Chicago, and believe it or not, even New York, are, you know, teeming with firms that would like to do more work with the government. When we put together our consortium of companies, at least, you know, our founding members, it's an amazing array of companies, from small companies that you never would have heard of to Virgin Orbit and Blue Origin.
Listeners, there's still time on our 60-minute format if you want to get a call in, or email us at drspace@thespaceshow.com, or you can use our toll-free number. As I said, there's still time for that. We don't hear a lot about USRA on the space show, or even at conferences that I attend. And I honestly don't know that I have met people that hand me a business card from USRA when I go to an AIAA conference or something else. So are you sort of, not you personally, but is the organization purposely sort of low-key? Does it want to go under the radar? It doesn't seem to be out there like, say, an advocate organization, for example.
Well, I think traditionally in the past we were probably a little bit more low-key. And, you know, we wanted to shine the light on the great work that our university members were doing, and we still do that. In fact, every year we hold a large space symposium for our membership, and they will come to Washington, and we'll usually have a topic, a discussion, and then presentations will be made and that sort of thing. So, however, you know, we are starting to get a little bit more out there in the news with some of the great work that our scientists and engineers and researchers are doing. And this would include SOFIA, this would include what we're doing with the quantum computer, this would include, you know, great work, really important work that is done at Arecibo in terms of planetary defense. I mean, literally watching, looking for objects that are, you know, coming towards the Earth and predicting trajectories and stuff like that. And then again, like I was talking about with our fantastic AFRL Scholars program, which we're just so proud of that. And I should mention we run the NASA Interns program, which we're equally proud of. I'm a retired airman, so I gravitate towards that. And we run the NASA postdoc program across all of the centers. So there's a lot of great things that we do, but we're probably not as concerned about, you know, look at us, we're great. We're more concerned with look at our scientists and engineers and the great work that they're doing, and look at the the workforce that we're bringing up to help make space more available for everybody to use and use it safely.
We are at the top of the hour for our 60-minute format. What should we have asked you about USRA that we didn't ask, or that I didn't know to ask, or that you want to be sure to get across to our listeners today?
Let's see here. I would say that, USRA, again, we have I don't want to leave. I'll just give you a quick rundown. We do a lot of significant earth science work, which is so important to understanding weather patterns and things like we saw with Harvey. We're also doing some fantastic work at Glenn Research Center in Ohio on microgravity and, for instance, how fire works in space, because it is different. So those are really important. And
Wait. Fire, like somebody sets a building on fire, that kind of fire?
That kind of fire, yes.
So where do you have fire in space?
What we've done is we have used the Cygnus resupply vehicle.
Uh-huh.
And on the return trip, we actually had a experiment where, flame was ignited, and then we were able to, monitor it and see how it burned and the characteristics of it. And, then there's still great science being done on that.
Interesting.
Yep. Oh, and I should also point out, we're doing some significant work on terrestrial and space weather out of Huntsville, serving Marshall Space Flight Center, where we're doing, earth sciences as well, some advanced technology development. And just the fact that we have, 550 or so fantastic employees who day in and day out are doing great things, not only for the United States, but really for the world. We're really proud of all of them.
Do you guys need a security clearance to be working at USRA?
Only in some programs. So on the side that works with the Air Force, yes, but the rest of it, no. So, for instance, out at some of the work that we do at NASA Ames, many of our employees are international, and we're able to work with them and they're able to do great work for NASA as well.
I'm really glad that you came on and talked to us about this, because again, in 17 years of the space show, this has definitely been under the radar. So I don't know what to say about that, but that's not a good sign. But I'm glad you have helped us surface with it. It's interesting. It's interesting to know that the government has this resource and how it works and who benefits from it and how they benefit from it. So,
I would encourage your listeners to go to our website, usra.edu, and just sort of browse around the site, and you can learn about a lot of the programs I've talked about, certainly in more detail, and learn more about the company and the rich history, and it is really a rich history and very interesting. And if you're down in Houston, once things kind of clear up, or here in Columbia, it's certainly worthwhile to, make a call and see if you could see the lobby here in Columbia. We have kind of a small museum. And then down in LPI, we have a terrific library. I mean, it is just absolutely amazing. And the other thing in Columbia to see is our STEM Activity Center, where we do some robotics programs. And we also have a ground station for the Keck Telescope, which is on the Big Island in Hawaii.
Dan, I want to thank you for spending an hour with us late at night tonight, and we really appreciate it. And we'll stay in touch with you and talk with you some more about USRA and some of the projects. And in future shows, maybe get more specific with you, if that's okay with you.
Sounds great. Thank you so much, Dan. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you for being with us. And listeners, thank you for your emails, and Michael for your call. And everybody have a great week for the rest of it. So remember, Hotel Mars is a pre-record tomorrow with Dr. Pete Warden at the Space Foundation program in San Francisco. And then we have our Friday program, and then we're off for a couple of days due to Labor Day holiday. So everybody have a great rest of the week. Keep looking up. Special thanks to Dan and all of you. Good night from the Space Show.